guitariste et chef de Pink Floyd, avec Rick Wright, organiste, Roger Waters, bassiste, et Nick Mason, batteur.
If I can remember what it was that we were going to play next, I'd tell you, but I can't.
Hello and welcome everybody to a new episode of our podcast called The Fingals Cave. In this episode, we have a very special guest who made a dream come true for Pink Floyd fans all over the world. Together with Gabe Pratt, he convinced Nick Mason in 2017 to create a superband to perform live not only any Pink Floyd music, but exactly those early songs which for the bigger part have not been played after 1969. Obviously, I'm speaking about Mr. Lee Harris. Thank you for joining us. It's really great to have you on the show.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So how are you? How are you? Everything's good?
Yeah, good. You know, I'm getting ready to go back out on the road. We're going to have a couple of days rehearsal in July before we start. And that's about, what, I don't know, 5-6 weeks away. And then I'm moving. House. So staying in France, but moving about 40 minutes north, a bit nearer to some cities, so I can do things like go and get some spices that you might not get in your in the countryside supermarket. You know, no, but so I've, you know, a few things going on.
So you're living in France for how long now?
I've been here 9 years. Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. It's a lovely place to live.
It is lovely. And, you know, one of the things I really love, having come from London, is, you know, in the winter, it's still light at 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, you know, whereas in England, you sort of start getting dark about 3 o'clock or half 3. It starts getting depressing, you know. But no,
it's still dark at 11 and it's getting dark at 2. So the first thing we always want to know, I mean, it's a Pink Floyd podcast, and what we like to do first, are you consider yourself being a big Pink Floyd fan?
Yeah, I'd say I was, yeah. I mean, you know, my first memory of Pink Floyd is probably being at about, well, when did Animals come out? 77?
Seven.
Yeah, so I would have been 2 years old listening to that album that my, you know, my parents were playing it. And, you know, as it was an album, it was probably about as big as I was. So, you know, I was looking at the photograph on the front and just hearing the animal noises and things like that, you know, for a kid, you know, I liked all that. And then when I was, I think 8 or 9. So anyway, 1980 we went to see, so I would have been 7 actually. My parents took me to see Pink Floyd performing The Wall at Earl's Court, so that's a memory, you know, that I've never forgotten. It's always been very vivid. Everything that happened in the show is always very vivid in my mind, and probably is, funnily enough, it's something that Guy, our bass players, I'm sure everyone knows who Guy is, Guy Pratt. He always also still says to this day, it's the best live thing he's ever seen. You know, I think it is for me as well. But yeah, and I'm going past that, you know, when I took up guitar when I was 13, I took it up primarily, I got into it because I saw Eric Clapton come on as a special guest at a Dire Straits concert, and that got me interested. Even though my dad had brought me up listening to, you know, Ritchie Blackmore you know, lots of Pink Floyd and Santana and all that kind of stuff, it was seeing Clapton come on as a surprise guest that made me really think about playing guitar. And then once I got the guitar, you know, I was constantly listening to The Wall and Dark Side of the Moon. And I suppose then I would have, well, that would have been about 80, that was 86. So then, you know, the following year, Momentary Lapse came out, you know, so I was learning how, trying to learn how to play things like On the Turning Away. And then I saw them live at Wembley Stadium and then at the Docklands Arena, where they couldn't even get the screen in properly to fit because the Docklands Arena wasn't tall enough. But, you know, so what I'm trying to spit out is that, you know, yeah, I would say I'm a huge Floyd fan. Yeah, yeah. It's been all the way through my life, yeah.
So did you only listen to the original albums or the few live recordings, or did you also get any bootlegs or...?
Sure. When before Delicate Sound of Thunder came out, I was interested in hearing, you know, what they were... You know, obviously this is the days before the internet, so you couldn't even get a full, complete set list of what was being played. So I'd go to a place in Kensington, London, called Kensington Market, and they used to have a lot of vinyl bootlegs then. So I'd get things from, I'm trying to think what I got there. I think I had one, I actually had a video that was from Madison Square Garden from the Momentary Lapse of Reason Tour. I think it's 87. Okay, yeah. I think it's 87 is that. And it's... So I sort of knew what they were playing, and I've got some Wall bootlegs then, you know. And I think I might have got, you know, one of those bootlegs that has a compilation of old BBC sessions and things. And, yes. You know, but yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah. So that's the sort of stuff I had. I didn't go deep, you know, I didn't go deep, but that's the sort of stuff I had, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same for me. It started with all the fairs, and we had a flea market here in Bonn, and I bought so many very bad bootlegs.
But
I mean, it's before the internet, as you say, before communities like Yeshkul, there was just no possibility to get any recent stuff.
Badly recorded, or bad in generation.
Bad in generation, I would say. Because most of them, later on, we got a much, much better quality, much, much better shape. Because in the end, it was Italian production. I don't know what generation it was in the end. So.
Sure.
So then you worked your way backwards, or is it that in the end, everything after 87 interests you most?
I think I was, at that age, I was just interested in what was... current, you know, what was actually happening then, and also because I was learning how to play guitar and listening to what David was doing then, I was sort of just more interested in that. You know, I remember going to Camden Market and getting there's that boot of the Division Bell rehearsals where they, I don't know where they are, is it somewhere in America?
Hangar,
and so, you know, so I was trying to get decent sounding quality ones. But the funny thing was, at that point, you know, my father had worked with Storm Thorgerson on and off. So, you know, and I'd gone down when they were doing the reshoots on the High Hopes video, which would have been January 94. And, you know, I've told this story elsewhere, but, you know, that was the first time I met Storm. And Storm said, you know, are you a fan of David's? And I said, well, yeah, he's one of my heroes. He said, oh, you know, would you like to hear the new album? I was like, yeah, of course, I'd love to hear it. And he went, he gave me the keys to his car, and I ran off to his car, and there was a tape in the car that said, Floyd Xmas Mix 93, and it was the Division Bell before it had been mixed. So I listened to it, and about 40 minutes later, he came over and said, I didn't mean the whole thing. So
okay.
I think he was more worried that I was going to run his car battery down than I was listening to the whole album. So, you know,
did you know already what you were listening to? Did you understand the...
No, I mean, I put it on and, you know, I heard, you know, what we now know as Cluster One. But, you know, things, you know, I say things that have been mixed. I mean, I remember hearing... I mean, this is all lost in the sand of time, but I remember hearing another guitar solo on something that isn't there now, but I don't remember what. I just remember when I heard the album, oh, that hasn't got that anymore, you know. It wasn't High Hopes, because at that point I knew how that was, because they used it for playback when they were filming. And actually, at that point, I know that half of the lap steel solo was on there. The second half of it hadn't been recorded yet, or at least hadn't been mixed into this tape anyway. So, you know, there were little things I noticed, but I was just sitting there with a big grin on my face. I couldn't believe it. But I do digress a bit here. That's not a bootleg, you know. But I do. I just remember at that point I was still, as I say, it's pre-internet, so you still couldn't get anything quickly. You know, you had to wait for it to be pressed and find it on a CD, and you know.
So at that time, did you were you looking for any early material already, like early 70s material?
Not really. I wasn't really going for that. That didn't really happen until I had the idea for the Sources, you know, thing. But I'd hear things every now and then. I mean, I think that, you know, because people know that, or the people who know that I came up with the idea and went to Guy and then on to Nick, I think, and because my idea was to focus on the early years, I think people have this idea that I'm some kind of early years Floyd freak, and I really am not. You know, the funny thing is, my original idea was that, you know, you maybe have this written down as a question to ask me, but and I'm already jumping the gun. But my original idea was that was quite selfish, really, because I'd been here in my house in France. My wife and I were renovating and building the house. I'd given up music for, I didn't know when I'd do anything, and I didn't know what it would be. And I went to see David Gilmour in Orange, and that was, I think,
2015?
It was 2015, but I can't remember if the album, if Rest of That Lock had even come out yet. I can't remember.
I think it was already out.
So there were some. I don't think I even had it yet. So I went to that gig really just to see Guy, you know, and it really propelled me back into wanting to play. So, and also to discover what it was that David really did. I mean, obviously, I knew that he always used a lot of delay in things at Echo, but for my you know, when I was playing professionally, it was always with this band called the Blockheads, or an English band, you know, not known everywhere outside of England. But really, I would just plug straight into an amplifier with a bit of overdrive and back the volume knob off on my guitar. I never used any delay or anything. So the last sort of, I don't know, 12 years of my life playing guitar was really that. And I consigned all my effects pedals into a, you know, a basket somewhere, you know. So I was really getting into what David was using, and I had, you know, there are a lot of things on the net that you can use. There's obviously that, there's Bjorn's Gilmourish.com, which is fantastic. There's a David Gilmour gear forum, which is just, you know, lots of different posts about different pedals and all this, you know, all nerdy stuff, but very useful if you want to learn how he achieved different sounds. So I would use these things to find out what pedals to buy, and I did that for about a year, and then eventually I went to see them again in Nîmes, which is about another 3 hours from where I live, and I took my dad with me, and we were sitting in this sort of, you know, in this box opposite the stage, and really by that point I was really missing playing, and I was so enthused by hearing David's band and, you know, playing all the Floyd stuff as well, that I thought I'd really, really love to play some Pink Floyd stuff with Guy. And then I'm thinking, well, he's just not going to want to play all the stuff he does with David. And then
you're comfortably numb, please.
Oh God, you know. And then so then because I was in this amphitheater, it reminded me of Pompeii. And then I suddenly thought, well, actually, you know, Set the Controls, Source of Fall, you know. I don't think David even played One of These Days at that gig. I can't remember, but he might have done. But, you know, but there were, I just think it made me think of that era. And then, you know, and then at some point my thought went to, well, if I'm going to ask Guy, you know, maybe if we could get Nick involved, it would make it a bit more, what's the word, you know, not, you know, give it some, make it valid, you know, give it some validity, yeah. You know.
It converts it from a cover band to a super band in the end.
Yeah, but it makes it something a bit more, you know, that you can take seriously as well. Like, you know, who would come and watch me, who no one's heard of, playing with Guy, you know what I mean? Who's not, you know, a celebrity that would put bums on seats, in, you know, do you know what I mean? So it made me think, well, if we did that, it has more of a, you know, Pink Floyd legacy thing. And at that point, there was, you know, we were beginning to see a lot of bands with original members that you couldn't really call tribute bands. But, you know, like, there was a David Bowie spin-off group with Tony Visconti playing bass. And with, I've gone completely blank, the drummer from the Spiders from Mars, and they were playing David Bowie songs that they'd recorded, you know, and then also some of his hits and things, you know, that they weren't on. But, you know, so there were things like that. So
in the end, I mean, in the end, it's the same. Sorry, yes.
You know, so that's when that was the idea. And then we went to, you know, I said to Guy, you know, about, I don't know, a few days after, I've had this idea. And he said, it's a great idea, but he'll never go for it. And I went, all right. And I went off and I thought about it, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And actually what happened was I spoke to my friend who actually came up with the idea for this David Bowie band that I was just talking about. And he said, well, why don't you just completely focus on the early Pink Floyd of Sid Barrett? And I thought, yeah, do you know what? I'm not really a huge Sid Barrett fan. I don't know if I'd really enjoy playing that. And I went off and I thought, well, hold on a minute. Actually, what if I just concentrated just on early Pink Floyd up till 70, you know, up to 73? And that's when it made more sense. And I went back to Guy and I said, listen, this is the idea, is we just do this period. How do I get it to him? And he said, okay, write it out properly. And then he sent it to Nick, and I think it said something like, you know, this might be mad, but I thought you should see it. And it was my outline. And Nick replied, you know, 3 hours later saying, not mad, interesting. And then we had, as you said earlier on, we met in 2017, and then that was it, you know.
So did you know Nick at that time already? No, your father?
I didn't know him. I'd met him a couple of times, but it wasn't even, okay. You know, it was just like, you know.
And when you had the idea of playing the most early songs, Sid Barrett's songs and everything, did you know by that time already that you would somehow meet the epicenter of the Pink Floyd fandom? That you just would hit it?
No, I didn't realise. No, I didn't. I mean, the funny thing is, as you can probably tell from what I just said, you know, I didn't think of myself as being a big Sid Barrett fan. I was kind of like, without wishing to sound rude, but I don't think any of them will hear this anyway, a typical American who doesn't think Pink Floyd existed before Dark Side of the Moon, you know, or if they did, they think that, like, that's all rubbish, you know. And once Nick actually said, oh, that's really interesting, I suddenly thought, oh, no, I'm now going to have to go back and really, you know, listen to this stuff properly. And at that point, this is, you know, 2016, 2017, I realised I actually really liked it, you know, and you start hearing it from with different ears, you know, because, and also it meant I didn't have to listen to Pulse for the thousandth time, you know. I suddenly had all this other music open to me that I could listen to. Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that I could see once we had our first rehearsal and it sounded good to us, and I started having to look at what songs we could actually, you know, perform, I could see actually there's a lot of these songs that haven't been played for a long time, and it's great, you know. I know, you know, the drums are not obviously a a stringed instrument. You know, you don't think of them as melodic. But playing with Nick is quite... It's very different to playing with other drummers, because he almost is just like another melodic instrument, you know. It's
yeah,
very,
we will come to that later.
Right, right.
Yes, because
yeah.
It's very, very special, you know. Yes.
But
okay.
Yeah, go on. You'll find this in me. Everyone listening will get really annoyed because I tend to free associate.
No, it's most
lot.
it's most interesting, but I fear to miss some cues.
no worries.
So at that point when you started listening to the very old stuff, did you only listen to the official albums, or did you already start listening to some unofficial recordings or concerts?
Both. Really, I think what I was doing was I'd listen to the original takes, original releases. And once I knew that we would be playing, let's say, for instance, I don't know, let's pick a song like Childhood's End, you know, so like we'd know that. And then, but then you'd find a live recording and hear that they suddenly go off and start playing a Cream song, don't they? I've forgotten what one it is. You know, Nick was talking to me about it. But we were going to do that, but then we were like, no, we don't want to copy exactly. Like, then it is almost like being a tribute band if you're doing stuff like that. But
yeah, I think you did your own Instead of Overdrive,
exactly. I mean, Instead of Overdrive, although I don't think there aren't that many versions of Instead of Overdrive out there, are there? But but what I would do is, you know, I would take... Once I knew we were going to be doing a specific song, I'd then go back and see if there are any live versions of it, to see if there are any parts that they did. Actually, I'll tell you what's a really good example is Atom Heart Mother, because you could, you know, I could, we actually sat down, the five of us, in a room and decided which sections of Atom Heart Mother we thought would work best live for us. So once we worked out what bits we were going to do, I would go off and sort of go, well, hold a minute, the first guitar solo that I'm playing, which is on the slide, I knew, for instance, that David had played that a few years back in London with Ron Geesin. So I
correct,
thought, well, I'd listen to that and think, well, mm-hmm. I'm quite interested in playing it how he might play it if he was playing it now. So actually what I do now is a composite of little bits of what he did there, coupled with something I think might be from a BBC session where there are overdubbed slide parts. So Gary and I lapse into that. And then when we go back into Funky Dung, you know, that isn't taken from anything. That's just us jamming, you know. So it's kind of like, I think, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to speak for the other guys, but certainly for me, with the songs, I would take the original release as a kind of demo, and then say, well, this is it. This is where the verse, chorus, and you know everything else is. But then, what have they done in the past? And if I like some one version better than another, I will probably incorporate that into what I'm playing, you know. So, listening to these older bootlegs was very helpful for that.
Yes, because it's funny that you say that, because your versions of these songs are much more similar, or let's call it a recent, updated, wonderful version of the original way they were playing it live.
That's
not,
nice.
Not
yeah.
a studio album.
That's nice to hear. Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
And Atom Heart Mother, I mean, not too many people are liking the original album, and it's a bit outdated. It's in comparison to metal, for example, it seems to be a little bit off nowadays, but
yeah.
the old live version, there are so many wonderful live versions.
Well, they, yeah, I mean,
1970 and 72.
Yeah. It's more rocking, and it's rawer, isn't it? It just sounds, you know, you can hear that it's Pink Floyd, you know, it's you know they're all working off of each other, playing together. It's great.
So when you started working with all the old titles in the Syd Barrett era and 70, 71, Was there any moment where you thought this might go very wrong? Because, I mean, these Pink Floyd fans might be a special hood.
No, I never. I mean, I don't know if people ever think about that sort of stuff. I mean, no. I mean, you're talking to the guy who, the day after Dingwalls, saw lots of reviews in the broadsheets, you know, in the newspapers in England, and hadn't even thought about the fact there were going to be reviews. You know, I didn't really think about anything like that. I think that, you know, we'd, you know, if Nick thought it was good and was happy with it, and Guy did,
yeah,
you know, and you know, that was good enough for me, you know. I wasn't really thinking about anything else. I think it's that old cliche that musicians always say, you know, you have to do it for yourself, you know, you have to be happy with it, and then it doesn't matter. So I think that the confidence was there that me being a big Pink Floyd fan, if I thought it was good, I knew other people would enjoy it, you know.
Yeah, I remember reading the first news about it, about the band, about you and Guy Pratt doing it, and I remember that we were all really, really excited about it.
Right, right.
But at the same time, we of course we feared that it might be another cover band doing,
yeah,
whatever cover bands are doing.
Sure, sure.
But it is in the end, and it always was. It was totally opposite. I mean, I was in Oberhausen in 2018, I think,
mm-hmm,
first row, and I was just, I mean, I almost cried because it was so different. And I've been to many Roger Waters concerts, David Gilmour concerts, and also Pink Floyd. I saw Pink Floyd live in Cologne in 89, I think,
yeah,
and 94.
Sure.
But, and that's something everybody I know is really, they love you about that, because it's so close to the original feeling that Pink Floyd creates, and that's something really fantastic about
I suppose,
the band.
You know, yeah, I think when you go and see huge shows, it's difficult, especially when people are on a big stage and they've got their own monitors in front of them, it's difficult for them to interact, you know. And also as time progresses, you know, I suppose that players finesse their parts down to a T, you know. So I think with us, you know, you can see us looking at each other. You can see if someone makes a mistake, someone else laughs, or whatever's going on, you can see us all looking, yeah, at each other and playing each other. But yeah, I mean, I think going back to what you were just saying before that, I mean, I think it's, you know, we're reinterpreting, we're not recreating, we're reinterpreting.
Correct.
And, you know, if we were recreating, it kind of would be, you know, it would be a cover band, a tribute band, you know.
And I don't want to talk too much about Guy Pratt, but we all knew, and he told in his we can. I mean, I love him, of course.
No, it's all right.
The funny thing is that we all knew that Guy Pratt loves Pink Floyd. He loves,
yeah,
David Gilmour and everything.
Yeah.
But he also told the stories about having a sofa on the back of the stage, sitting with Nick Mason in between songs or during songs, because there was so much going on, but not music.
Mm-hmm.
And he must be so happy about doing what he can do right now. And if I watch the concerts, and I was, as I said, in Oberhausen and then again in Rome, which was just a wonderful night in an open auditorium, as you know. And seeing him playing his bass guitar the way he wants to, and just turning back to Nick, supporting Nick sometimes, mm-hmm, with the cues,
yeah,
and everything, and his little remarks about the Nile song, puts it all together. So
absolutely. And I remember when we came off, the day that all those reviews came out that I was talking about, I remember getting to the Half Moon in Putney for our second show, and I was the first one there, and Nick turned up, and I said, "Have you seen the reviews?" And he said, "You know, I couldn't have written them better myself, you know." And and I said to Nick, I knew what's happened was going to happen, which is that I knew that people would suddenly go, "Oh my God, Gary Kemp can play guitar." Because it's like, you know, it's like, what do you think he's been doing for the last 40 years? But of course, you know, Nick said to me, you know, the thing is that when people think of New Romantics, they don't think of music, they think of clothes. you know. So it's especially in England, you know, people think of New Romantics and they do think of all that kind of, you know, early 80s, what they're all the outfits and things. But no, I mean, Gary's a phenomenal guitar player, you know, and it works really well. I mean, we actually met up before the band actually got together. We were the first two to actually play together just to make sure we got on musically. We already knew each other, you know, we weren't great friends, but we knew each other. And, you know, and that worked out really well. You know, we worked. I mean, I was used to playing with another guitar player. He wasn't. But because I was used to it, I could make it easy for him to do it. You know, he'd be like, what are you going to be doing when I'm here? And I said, I won't be there. I'll be at the other end of the neck with a different inversion. Don't worry about it. And, you know, he never had to worry about what I was doing and vice versa. So it was good.
So working with a complete band just seems to be a joy. Tom Bacon is a wonderful keyboarder. I mean, everything works very well. And one specific thing I would like to know, Nick Mason, we mentioned it already, but I mean, he seems to be just a lovely guy, and it's being a Pink Floyd member, it's not easy, I would say. I mean, David Gilmour, Roger Waters, we shouldn't talk about that their fight and everything, and they both seem a bit grumpy these days, and having that wall through Twitter and everything, having Polly Samson strange.
Maybe they're grumpy, you know, with each other, but I don't think they're particularly, you know, I mean, I've met both of them, and they weren't grumpy to me, you know, when I met them, you know what I mean?
Okay, that's great to know. That's great to know. So, but back to Nick Mason, I mean, it's as you said, the way he plays the drums is something very special, and for me personally, Astronomy Domine, the way the drums there are so... And it's funny that you said it's a very melodic way of playing it, because a friend of mine who doesn't know Pink Floyd very well, he's my best friend, but he went with me to all the concerts, not knowing one single song.
Poor boy.
Still not knowing one single song, but he loved both concerts. And Lorelei, the festival, it's the same guy.
Sure.
I will go with.
Cool.
And he's already looking forward to it, and he told me Astronomy Domini every single time. It's so great, and the drums are so great, and somehow the mixing on the live shows is the drums are so, I wouldn't say aggressive, but upfront. It's really love you. The only band I could think of where it's almost the same is Emerson, Lake, Palmer. Where Carl Palmer is also a real member of the band doing his part.
Sure.
So how was it when you decided, okay, let's go to let's book a room and start playing?
It's funny because actually, Guy and Gary have told in the past that the first song we played together was Interstellar Overdrive, but it wasn't. I've got the emails where I told everyone what we were going to play on the first day, and it was the first thing we actually all played together was Astronomy Domini. I think the first time in that, you know, that I realised, pick my words carefully, you know, but it was, I suppose when I realised how special Nick was, really, was when we played Set the Controls. And I realised that all he was doing was going, dum-de-dum-dum, dum-de-dum-dum. And when you watch anyone in a tribute band doing it, they never get it right. They never do, or maybe they're not trying to get it right, but they never do what he does. And that's when I was like, yes, that is Nick Mason, you know. And it's funny because I think that's probably, I think he always says it's his favourite Pink Floyd song. I don't know if it's necessarily his favourite Pink Floyd song to play, but I know he says it's his favourite Pink Floyd song. But, you know, it is a really special, you know, bit of percussion that he does on that. And also then he gets quite thunderous with his double bass drums, you know, when the solos go off. There's a lot of light and shade in that song, you know. It's not just a pure out rock and roll tune, you know. But yeah, I think that was special. I think by the end of that get together, you know, we realized that we had something that was something that we all enjoyed doing, you know. And then we had another rehearsal, and it actually came together very quickly. I think we had two. I'd have to check my diaries, but I think it was something like, it might have been three rehearsals, and then we had a, what do you call it? Like a showcase. So we had management, tour management, lighting company, you know, Brit Row came down, sound company, and friends and family came. So we could actually have an audience, and that was in January. So that we had rehearsal before that, and then we had the showcase. And then we decided, right, we're going to, you know, I mean, obviously our agent, John Giddings, came down, and then that was it. We had the Half Moon, the Dingwalls and Half Moon gigs booked, and they were putting in the European tour, obviously at the same time for September. But it was, it moved very quickly from that first time in the rehearsal room. It would have been October, November, December, January showcase, February, March, April, May, you know, it was very quick for a band to get together, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked briefly about Roger Waters and David Gilmour.
Yeah.
Roger Waters joined you in New York.
Yes.
At a very special night and supported you on Set the Controls for the Art of the Sun.
Yeah.
So how was it for you? Because for us, there's a video on YouTube and it's a wonderful version and it's outstanding.
It's obviously fantastic when the person who wrote, you know, the material likes what you do, you know, that's fantastic. When Roger came down, it was a funny one because I don't even remember ever being told that it was a possibility that he would. And on the day I had someone send me a social media message saying, is it true Roger Waters is performing with you tonight? Which I ignored because I don't tend to answer people I don't know, you know, asking me questions that I would never answer anyway, you know. But that was the first time I thought about it. And I was like, I wonder why that person's asking that question. And then I got to soundcheck at the Beacon. It would have been about 5:30, 6 o'clock. And I went on stage just to check my gear. And a tour manager came over and said, production manager, I should say, came over and said, oh, Nick wants to see you upstairs. And I thought, that's weird. He's never done that. Like, you know, can you come and see me? I'm like, that's weird. So I went up and actually all the bands were in the dressing room. And Nick said, Roger's going to join us tonight. And I burst out laughing, saying, yeah, right, you know. And he said, no, he is. And I went, ha, ha, ha. And just laughed. And then Gary looked at me and said, no, he is. Because they realised I thought it was a joke. I said, oh, all right, you know, because it's now like 6:15 or so, and the show starts in 2 hours. And I was like, well, you know, what happened was that Roger had lost his mobile phone and didn't know Nick's phone number. I suppose didn't know his email address without looking at it, you know, and wasn't able to reply to Nick, who had asked him, would you like to come and do something? So he finally got hold of him at about 6 o'clock that night when the cab driver where he'd left his phone with managed to get it back to him. And so when he turned up at about, I think it was about 15, about 20 minutes before we went on stage. And we told him, I think he picked Set the Controls. So we didn't even get to run through it with him. We just told him what we did. Like, you know, the Gary does a solo, I do a solo, then it goes down and, you know, whatever. So we all met him before. And then the really, what I remember about that gig, apart from the fact that my family were there, my sister and my parents, was that when we started playing, opposite me was one of the exit doors back out into the lobby, and Roger was standing behind the whole audience at the exit door watching it with a big smile on his face while we're playing Interstellar Overdrive and Astronomy Domini. That was really funny. And then our tour manager went and, you know, went with him and took him around the back. So the whole of the audience is sitting there not knowing that Roger's standing behind them watching, you know. And then when he came on, yeah, it was great. I mean, it was rather funny because, you know, Nick calls me the professor because I like to know if the band have ever played at a certain venue we're playing before. So he calls me the professor. So he asked me that night, you know, when did I first play in New York? And I told him it was 1967. And he said, no, I don't think it was. And I was like, well, why did you bloody ask me then? You know, if you knew what it was. So anyway, what happened was when Roger came out, you know, we had the joke that Nick tells about how, you know, he never got to play the gong. And then, of course, the lights went down and Roger came out and took the mallet from him. So that was all a big joke. And then Roger came out and, you know, did his, you know, walk across the stage saying hi to the audience. And then he went up to the microphone, looked at me in the eyes and said, I remember it well. It was 1969. And I was like, what? You know, so he's coming out and he's telling me I'm wrong, you know. And then I thought, there's no way that Pink Floyd first played in New York in 1969. And I actually text Andrew King, who was one of the managers of the Floyd back in 67 when Sid was around. He told me, no, they never played in 67, but it would have been 1968. So I was wrong and Roger was wrong. It was actually 1968. But it was obviously a special occasion. You know, something like that is always going to get a lot of people talking. You know, I suppose in a way it's a, well, not in a way. I mean, it's a reunion of Pink Floyd of sorts, you know. I think it's probably the last one we've had for a long time. I don't think we've had any. You know, David hasn't played with Nick with us. David hasn't obviously not played with Roger. So that is the last one we've had.
O2, The Wall.
Yeah, the one before that was the last one. So the last time any Pink Floyd members have played together, you know, original members, would that must be it at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we got off stage and, you know, it was all over the internet already, you know. It was quite a, you know, a cool thing to be part of. Yeah, yeah.
So did you meet Roger backstage? Did you talk?
I met him before the show. I gave him a hug during the show when he walked off. I decided not to go up and have a chat with him after the show because I thought, you know what? I've really enjoyed that. I don't want to, you know, I know. He can be prickly, and I didn't want to encounter that. Not that I thought I would, but I thought I might, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why. So I didn't. But I also did have, as I said, my sister and her family and my parents had come all the way there. So I needed to spend time with them. It was special.
I thought about Guy Pratt because he, I know that something happened, Live Aid, that Richard Wright somehow mentioned to Roger Waters that Guy Pratt would play the bass this way at this song, and Roger.
Oh yeah, that was that. That was
actually said, I don't care what your step song.
Yeah, yeah. Well, things are said in, you know, in jest or in the heat of the moment. But I mean, all I know is that, you know, don't forget that Guy did actually play with Roger at that benefit concert that he played with David, you know, what Guy was playing at that as well. So there was no, you know, there's no bad blood between them, you know.
Okay, great. Yeah. Great. So I would like to talk with you about another show, Luxembourg 2018.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how. At one.
Well, I'm going to say, I don't know how we fit on the stage. Is that what you're going to say? No.
I mean, before we start talking about that concert, I mean, for anybody who might not know, the last song, Sourceful of Secrets, was performed by the audience, at least the celestial voices. And I still can't listen to it without getting goosebumps and almost
same here.
Crying
because absolutely same here. Yeah,
it's so special in so many ways because it strongly proves how happy everyone is that you do that.
Yeah,
And it's the perfect bridge between the very old songs and the, I mean, us as being big Pink Floyd fans, we are mostly live in the past, and we try to research and find old audience recordings, and some people are remastering it, and it's always something being 50 years off or 60 years. And what happens when one is on a concert from Nick Mason's Source Floor Secrets, there's a perfect bridge between that time mm-hmm. and now. And having an audience, a room full of people who are not just capable, but able to sing the whole part is so special. And if you then listen to the whole concert, the complete concert is something so special, because as Guy mentions, if I remember correctly, that when they had to be quiet, they were quiet. When they had to be enthusiastic, they were.
Yeah.
So was it a special night for you too?
It it's really difficult to answer this without maybe upsetting people. I don't really enjoy shows where the stage is like, you know, like the first gigs we did, Dean Walls and Half Moon. Dean Walls was okay. Half Moon was tiny. And this was like that. And you're right on top of your amplifier, so you can't have it as loud as you want, so you can't get the feedback you want in certain songs. It's very hot in there, you know. I mean, I've got a fan, but it was still so hot. But what gets you through a show like that is when you have an audience like that. And the audience, as you're saying, I mean, like, what I can see up the front is just people totally, you know, just, you know, euphoric, you know, they're so happy, they're hearing these songs. And you're not that close, especially when you're playing in a theatre and you've got, I don't know, maybe where there might be an orchestra pit in front of you. So you have an even, you know, more of a distance between you and the front row, even in some of the small theatres we play in. So it basically is what is special about those sort of shows that you're talking about. And the fact that you're that close to the audience. And what happened in Celestial Voices, we weren't expecting that, because that had never happened anywhere before. And it never happened anywhere again until we played Den Atelier again, you know, last year, you know. And last year, the audience knew that they had to really go for it. So, you know, and I was ready for it, and I took my in-ear monitors out so I could hear it properly. First time we played there, we didn't have in-ear monitors, so it was a real shock for us, because, you know, we could hear the audience immediately. You know, it was fantastic. But yeah, it is the audience that makes those things special. Yeah.
So talking about special concerts, you're going to Pompeii this year in summer.
Yes.
So this will be the first time Echoes being played at Pompeii.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget
the original Pompeii.
Yeah, but don't forget, you know, we are, you know, we're about a mile down the road from where it was filmed, you know, and where David's show was. So it's not exactly the same place, you know. But obviously, you know, it's a bit like Wembley Stadium isn't no longer where Wembley Stadium used to be. So it's a similar kind of thing to that. But yeah, I mean, I think obviously this shows, I should think that Pompeii is just in, you know, every Pink Floyd fan who knows more than another brick in the wall. You know, they know about Pompeii, you know. I think we sold it out in about a day or two, I think it sold out, which is quick, you know, very quick for us outside of England, you know.
And then you're going to Australia for the first time.
Yes.
Which is lovely.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Long way to go. Yeah, again, I think, you know, they probably starved of having... I suppose Roger goes over there. I don't know the last time David ever been there. I don't think he has.
No, I wouldn't say so. Or maybe, you know, Sydney, so, yeah, maybe Melbourne.
Maybe, I don't,
not latest tours, I would say.
No, I mean, I know Pink Floyd, when he was in Pink Floyd, they were there in 89 maybe, or 88 maybe. I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm sure that, you know, whenever we play, we always... I don't think we've ever done anything that I'd recall, like we've had a bad night or anything. We always, you know, we always try and put on the best show we can. So hopefully we'll please a lot of people who haven't seen anyone from Pink Floyd for a long time, you know.
So will there be any surprises after? I mean, Echoes wasn't really a surprise because it's called the Echoes Tour.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the end, yeah. Playing Echoes is a wonderful thing. Will there be any new songs?
This is still the Echoes Tour, so we'll just be playing what we've played on, you know, on the Echoes Tour. I mean, I don't know if we'll. I think we stopped playing Interstellar Overdrive. I think about sort of halfway through the Echoes tour, primarily because we realised that what was happening was that we do set the controls for the Heart of the Sun, and then it gets to the part where Dom and Gary do a big sort of breakdown, and Gary's doing all his, you know, twiddling all his bits. And then we go off and come back and do Instead of Overdrive. And then Gary just starts twiddling all his bits again. So it's kind of like doing two things in the same, you know, one after the other, where the same thing's happening. So we decided to cut that. But I'd quite like to put a bit of Interstellar Overdrive back in. I think the set misses that riff, you know, at least, you know, it misses that bit of Sid. And especially because the Sid film's just come out. I think it'd be good to have it back in the set, or some of it anyway. Maybe not a 6-minute version, but we'll do it.
It was a great opening. I mean, it's one of these days is also great, but
I think Interstellar Overdrive was what was good about having that was it told the audience this is what we're doing, you know. Yes. And whereas One of These Days was just like, well, we didn't really want to go back on doing exactly the same order of songs, but One of These Days I kind of feel is something that we. From playing that era of Pink Floyd, you kind of have to do it. So it's good to get rid of it earlier on, you know.
It's a funny thing. I had a discussion with some of my friends here, Pink Floyd fan friends, and it's 50-50. Some of them just say, yeah, I can't listen to One of These Days anymore. It's the rock version of Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, I still love it. Every single version I love. And
I
listen to it all day.
Yeah, I like, you know... I do like the early versions where it was a bit more raucous before it became more of a bluesy thing, you know, or not bluesy, but like, you know, I suppose David would play more of a blues solo, you know, and the early ones. It's funny because I remember I copied very close to the record, to the actual medal version on the on our first tour and on the Live at the Roundhouse. That's very close to that. Think I might only have put in like 8 bars difference, you know. And I remember reading online someone saying, I can't stand the way Lee Harris, you know, just improvises. I was like, no, you obviously haven't listened to you've obviously been listening to the Pulse version for the last 30 years and not listened to the original one, because that's what I'm doing, you know. It's one of the few, you know, one of the few parts of the set where I kind of do copy what David did, you know, originally. But then again, there you go. That's kind of like why you can't really listen to what people say, because you've got to do what you want to do, you know.
Did you ever consider putting in on a set list, putting in one of your own compositions or anything off Pink Floyd?
No. I think, you know, some people have said, you know, why don't you play some solo Sid stuff? But, you know... Nick's not on any of that. I don't think that's, you know, it's Nick's name on the marquee. I don't really think there's much point in doing things like that, unless Nick said, why don't we do that? But I don't think that's something Nick would think about doing. I think there's plenty of other songs from the early years that if we are going to do anything again, there are still other songs we could still attempt, and maybe, you know, time to maybe get rid of some of the ones we're doing, you know. But I don't know. I mean, we haven't had any discussion about, you know, even writing our own material. I mean, I can understand why people ask if we would do that. And I think it would be interesting to hear what we might do. But what would you do? Would you have to write a kind of song in the style of Sid Barrett? That would just be weird, you know. So you know, or a song in the style of 1968 Pink Floyd. It, you know, then if you don't do that and you do something you do now, it might sound totally different to all this other stuff that we play, all the other Pink Floyd stuff. Totally. So I don't really know. I think that if we were ever going to do anything like that, I think it would be if we got asked to do music for a movie or, you know, a video game or a TV show or something like that. I don't think, you know, we'd be, you know, I don't think we'd be looking at recording our own album and then going out and playing that album and then some Pink Floyd songs, I think. But yeah. You know, I might be wrong. I might be wrong, but it doesn't seem
I
right.
I think it's a monster you created yourself because, as I said before, you created a bridge between the early 60s or late 60s and nowadays. And of course, I totally get you and I totally understand what everything you would do might be wrong because they're expecting something they know but don't know yet.
Yeah.
I think asking for a new composition or songs by your own is the nicest thing to ask for.
Yeah, because absolutely. They really
trust you as a band in creating something which is Pink Floydish, but your own, so to speak. But I understand that it's, I think that to achieve is almost impossible.
Yeah, I agree. But who knows? I mean, I never thought I'd be doing this. So, you know, I never thought I'd be in this band. So you never know what's around the corner, you know.
The only thing I can say is please don't stop playing live. It's just wonderful. Everything that came up so far is just great. And thank you very much for taking your time. And it was a lovely chat.
Cool.
Very nice. And thank you all for listening. This was our latest episode of Fingal's Cave podcast. And we will have another special guest next episode. Thank you very much for listening. And have a good night, a good day. Bye-bye.